This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Down to Business. My name is Jeff, and I'm recording this episode from the Mind's Eye studio just outside St. Louis in Belleville, Illinois. In today's episode, we'll explore a variety of stories from some of my favorite business publications, including Fast Company, Fortune, and Forbes. So settle in. It's time to get down to business. Our first story this week appears in Fast Company magazine, and it's entitled Minor League Baseball Isn't Afraid to Get Weird, and it's paying off. Minor League Baseball teams are attracting a new generation of fans with wacky mascots and hyper-local branding. Just a short drive outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, the quaint city of Kannapolis is seeing a rapid economic revival. The city, which is traditionally known for its textile mills, has recently transformed into a research hub in the southeast. And right in Kannapolis City Center, less than a 10-minute walk from the Georgian-style City Hall, sits Atrium Health Ballpark, the home of the minor league baseball team known as the Cannonballers. Over the last 5 years, the Cannonballers have played an increasingly vital role in Kannapolis's revitalization. Throughout the course of a season, the team's total attendance is around 200,000 people, a number much larger than Kannapolis' official population of 60,000. It's a beautiful ballpark, and the community and small businesses love it, says Trevor Wilt, who's in charge of entertainment and fan engagement for the Cannonballers. He adds that since there aren't many large companies in Kannapolis, small mom-and-pop shops rely on baseball games to bring people downtown. It helps out the economic development around the entire downtown Kannapolis. Businesses are now thriving, and they can't wait for baseball season because they get more customers. A large factor of the Cannonballers' growing brand is their mascot, a mustachioed daredevil with a baseball head and a devilish grin. His name is Boomer, and he was chosen by thousands of voting fans in 2019 as part of a large revamp of the team's identity. In appearance, he resembles Dale Earnhardt, NASCAR legend and hometown hero for the small North Carolina town. Compared to the buttoned-up branding of most Major League Baseball teams, Boomer might seem a little odd. But in baseball's minor leagues, there are 119 other teams just like the Cannonballers. Team owners have the flexibility to be more creative with just about every aspect of their team, the name, the mascot, stadium traditions, and even the rules of the game. Mascots range from a buck-toted lug nut in Lansing, Michigan, to a smirking trio of nuts in Modesto, California. A recent spurt in creative freedom has ushered in the era of fun and surging sales in minor league baseball. And last year, minor league baseball games around the country saw more than 30 million fans in attendance, the highest number since COVID. This year, industry experts expect even more. With teams stationed in small towns and cities, the minor leagues develop young prospects with the goal of them eventually playing for one of the 30 MLB teams. Each MLB team has four MILB affiliate teams. Players just start out, begin at the single A level, then they can move on to high A, then double A, and finally they can reach triple A, where they play at the highest minor league level before hopefully being called up to the major leagues, where their baseball skills will be broadcast to millions of viewers across the country. The Kannapolis Cannonballers are the single A affiliate of the Chicago White Sox, which means the players on the team are currently at the lowest minor league level. Those players will work to one day reach the MLB for the White Sox or potentially get traded to another team along the way. Oftentimes, minor league baseball teams are the only professional sports teams that operate in a community. The AAA Albuquerque Isotopes and AA New Hampshire Fisher Cats are the only professional sports clubs that exist in the states of New Mexico and New Hampshire, respectively. Minor league games cater to families looking for a fun day or night out, and owners lean in the casual nature of the league. We're affordable and we're accessible, says Peter Frund, the CEO and co-founder of Diamond Baseball Holdings, a group that currently owns over a third of minor league affiliate teams. Minor league baseball is a night out that is really affordable, can feel really good, and can feel really local. I think that's where we're a really critical piece for every city that we operate in. Minor League Baseball also acts as an incubator and testing lab for MLB. The pitch clock, which debuted in the MLB for the 2023 season, was first introduced in minor league games 7 years earlier. Frund adds that baseball park staples like bobblehead giveaways once started as an idea from minor league teams. Minor league team baseball owners historically have just been able to try things without controversy, he says. What works well trickles up, and it's been really cool to see those things happen. For 120 teams across the country, the freedom to experiment means the freedom to create. Their creativity and excitement is the fun of minor league baseball, and it pays. Mascots and merch. Because the average player moves through minor league levels typically over the course of 3 to 6 years, teams can't build brands and sell tickets based on star power. Instead, they play into their home city's history and come up with hyper-local identities. The resulting team brands are nothing short of full-on wacky. In Alabama, the Montgomery Biscuits team identity reflects the delicacy of a fluffy, traditional southern biscuit. Rome, Georgia hosts a minor league team called the Rome Emperors, which is represented by an emperor penguin mascot wearing a traditional Roman toga and laurel wreath. The name Cannonballers pays homage to Cannapolis's history of being home to Cannon Mills, the one-time largest towel manufacturer in the world. Wilt says that the old souls of the town appreciate the reference to Cannapolis's history. Oftentimes, games attendees will come up to him and tell him of their family's history with the town and Cannon Mills. In South Carolina, the Hub City Spartanburgers are similarly drawing on its city's history to debut a fan-friendly brand. This team is rebranding of North Carolina's Down East Wood Ducks, which was bought by Diamond Baseball Holdings in 2023. The Ducks moved locations to Spartanburg, South Carolina, and the team became the Spartanburgers just in time to begin operation for the 2025 season. The story of the Spartanburger name is simple enough, according to the team's general manager, Tyson Jeffers, who hopes this minor league team will put its city on the map. Someone from Texas says, "I'm a Texan." Someone from New York says, "I'm a New Yorker." And people from Spartanburg call themselves a Spartanburger, Jeffries says. It's truly a community name, but we've put a very minor league spin on it by introducing and leaning into the hamburger. Yes, the hamburger. To go alongside the Spartanburger name, the team will flaunt a bat-wielding, conductor's hat-wearing hamburger mascot named Chuck. Chuck's signature pose is running, tongue out, as if he sleeps deep in concentration or is just really hungry. The striped conductor's hat is a nod to Spartanburg's history as the transportation hub of the Southeast. Train lines would flow into Spartanburg and then disperse, says Jeffers. This piece of city history is also where the Hub City and the team Hub City Spartanburgers comes from. And even though the Spartanburgers have yet to play a single game, that lip-licking burger is already bringing in cash. Jeffers says that the Spartanburgers have shipped merchandise to all 50 states and internationally to countries including Canada, Germany, and Spain. He adds that he sees people come to the Spartanburg ballpark every day just to buy merchandise. The Spartanburgers' merchandise ranges from hamburger t-shirts and cooking aprons to more traditional-looking baseball jerseys with only text and no mascot. Jeffers says that he wants to have fun while respecting the fact that not everybody wants to walk around wearing a giant hamburger. We're really conscious in the development of our brand to make sure that we hit as many people as we could while still having a lot of fun. The merchandise has been really well received, he says. Back in Cannapolis, Wilt says that the Cannonballers' fun, history-oriented brand similarly has led to soaring merchandise and ticket sales. The Cannonballers became the Cannonballers in 2019, rebranding from the Intimidators. The Intimidators were bottom of the totem pole for both merchandise and ticket sales, Wilt says. But after adopting the playful Cannonballers identity, Wilt says the team has been in the top 20 among all minor league teams in merchandise sales for 5 years straight. Be prepared. On April 15th, when the Spartanburgers take their home field for the first time, the team will be bringing a new tradition with them. They'll hand out wooden train whistles to attending fans in the hopes that the stadium will squeal to life whenever something good happens. The Spartanburgers are the high-A affiliate of the Texas Rangers. Jeffers says that the Rangers front office is just as excited for this new tradition as the team in Spartanburg is, because the noise will prepare these young players for one day focusing in larger, louder stadiums. The major leagues see that these distractions that minor league teams are doing are helping to develop and benefit their players, Jeffers says. If you're the away team in a facility like Yankee Stadium, imagine the things that the crowd is saying to you. Huge distraction. So for you to be prepared for that as a player can be really beneficial. The train whistlers are one chapter in a long history of wacky traditions among minor league teams. Montgomery Biscuits shoot real biscuits into the crowds. Wilt of the Cannonballers has a tradition of going on the field every game and wearing a gold sequin bow tie. These games become intimate experiences unique to each city a team operates in. Going to minor league games has become a pastime for families who either don't have access or the resources to get to a Major League Baseball game, which of course includes the newest, younger generation of baseball fans. One extra bonus for the players involved, they get to interact with and build the next generation of baseball fans. Jeffers says that unlike major league teams, most minor league teams allow opportunities for young fans to interact face-to-face with the players for an extended period of time. The kids get that opportunity to say hello to a player that they hope is going to be a superstar one day, and that's a really special moment for that kid, Jeffers says. It also is a special moment for the player to recognize that this kid looks at them as the superstar already, even though they're just at the beginning of their path to that. Our next story is also from Fast Company magazine, called "The Apple Watch Faces a Wearables Wake-Up Call." Apple still dominates the wearables market, but experts warn that the company's lead could be slipping. Apple Watch sales are enduring a years-long backslide. While Apple first launched its watch in 2015, sales didn't spike until the pandemic, when consumers were highly focused on their health. But competitors quickly caught up, with fitness-focused companies like Garmin integrating more smart technology. Meanwhile, Apple stumbled in adding compelling new features, getting into some legal spats along the way. For the past 3 years, Apple Watch sales have declined year over year, according to research firm IDC. In 2022, Apple sold 43 million units. By 2024, the number had dropped to 34 million. The Apple Watch also lost market share, falling from 29.6% to 22.5%, while high-end competitor Garmin and budget alternatives like Huawei and Xiaomi gained ground. And although Apple doesn't break out revenue by individual product, its wearable home accessory segment was the only one to decline year over year in the fourth quarter. Apple is in a weird spot, says Jitesh Ubrani, a research manager at IDC studying wearables. They make great stuff, but at least on the watch side, things are a little bit iterative. Where did all the Apple Watch upgraders go? Apple Watch sales have fallen far from their 22 peak. While some analysts remain optimistic, Ubrani expects Apple will regain modest growth in 25. The numbers are still well below pandemic highs. Part of the drop, experts say, comes down to durability. A lot of people bought a new smartwatch or replacement smartwatch during the pandemic, says Ben Haddon, analyst of connected devices for CCS. Those devices are yet to reach the point where they are beginning to be replaced. So there's that longevity of device, especially for the top-end wearables, that does hamper growth. Unlike the iPhone, which users often upgrade for new features, the Apple Watch hasn't changed dramatically in recent years. Ubrani notes that the device's health and fitness sensors have remained largely consistent across generations. You're not getting a whole new experience apart from maybe a shiny new case, he said. That could soon change, according to Bloomberg. Apple is currently testing watches with added cameras and Apple Intelligence. Ubrani says these updates could appeal to Apple loyalists, but they've already standard features among competitors. If we're talking AI, I think Apple is behind, and visual intelligence would be part of that, he says. In terms of adding cameras, they wouldn't be the first one. Who needs an Apple Watch these days? Apple isn't the only company facing headwinds. The entire smartwatch industry has seen declining sales over the past 3 years, per IDC. But Apple's competitors have weathered the downturn more gracefully. In 2023, when Apple Watch sales fell 15.8%, Google declined just 4.3%. And while both are expected to return to growth in 2025, Google's projected 9.4% gain far outpaces Apple's 4.9%. Even in a shrinking market, Garmin is gaining ground. Though its share remains modest at about 5%, the company sold nearly 2 million more watches in 2024 than in the previous year. You've got a group of consumers that are looking to buy the best, top-of-the-range fitness trackers, Haddon says. They may have gone into them through the Apple Watch or the Samsung Watch, but increasingly they're realizing that they want it for the pure fitness element. Garmin is probably best positioned to serve that demand. The wearables category has also diversified. Watches once dominated the space, but now consumers can choose from smart rings that track sleep, headbands that boost focus, and AI-powered sunglasses. While these devices are still niche, Haddon says their rapid growth poses a longer-term threat. Apple sold an estimated 40 million watches last year. By contrast, only about 2 million smart rings were sold across all providers. If they continue to grow very quickly, then they may start to become the real challenger to watches, he contends. And some consumers are simply over it. Maybe they grew tired of the endless notifications. Maybe they were shamed for wearing an Apple Watch at their wedding. Maybe they just missed the feel of a classic timepiece. There's been a resurgence of traditional watches, Urbani says. People like the idea of having something that's a little less mass-produced, something that's away from the mainstream. Our third story of this episode comes from Fortune magazine called When AI Builds AI, The Next Great Inventors Might Not Be Human. DeepSeek's blockbuster release of its R1 reasoning model on January 20th unleashed a firestorm of discussion about the U.S.-China technological rivalry and the wisdom of AI infrastructure spending, resulting in a sharp dip in the stock prices of many leading AI companies. But buried within all of this controversy lies perhaps the least discussed and most consequential trend in the journey toward artificial general intelligence, the increasing role of AI systems in designing, building, and refining their next-generation successors. Increasingly, AI is building AI. In the paper accompanying the launch of R1, DeepSeek explained how it took advantage of techniques such as a synthetic data generation, distillation, and machine-driven reinforcement learning to produce a model that exceeded the current state-of-the-art. Each of these approaches can be explained another way as harnessing the capabilities of an existing AI model to assist in the training of a more advanced version. DeepSeek is far from alone in using these AI techniques to advance AI. Mark Zuckerberg predicts that the mid-level engineers at Meta may soon be replaced by AI counterparts, and that Llama 3, his company's large language model, helps us experiment and iterate faster, building capabilities we want to refine and expand in Llama 4. NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang says that, spoken at length about creating virtual environments in which AI systems supervise the training of robotic systems, we can create multiple different multiverses, allowing robots to learn in parallel, possibly learning in 100,000 different ways at the same time. This isn't quite yet the singularity when intelligent machines autonomously self-replicate, but it is something new and potentially profound. Even amidst such dizzying progress in AI models, though, it's not uncommon to hear some observers talk about the potential slowing of what's called the scaling laws, the observed principles that AI models increase in performance in direct relationship to the quantity of data, power, and compute applied to them. The release from DeepSeek and several subsequent announcements from other companies suggest that arguments of the scaling law's demise may be greatly exaggerated. In fact, innovations in AI development are leading to entirely new vectors for scaling, all enabled by AI itself. Progress isn't slowing down. It's speeding up, and that's thanks to AI. Perhaps the oldest method of using AI to create AI is through synthetic data, or using data created by AI systems to further train and refine other AI systems. The term synthetic data implies that the generated versions of data are somehow inferior to organic data. In practice, the opposite is proving to be true. Synthetic data generation allows AI systems to create realistic training examples tailored to specific domains or edge cases that might be underrepresented in real-world datasets. It's reasonable to be skeptical of synthetic data as a limitless scaling vector. One recent paper observed that after a few rounds of synthetic data creation, the models degraded quickly. Even with limitations, this capability can accelerate innovation in areas where acquiring real data might be impractical, such as medical imaging or modeling protein folding to discover new drugs. Another key technique that DeepSeek's release highlighted was the distillation of models, where large, computationally expensive models transfer their knowledge and capabilities to smaller, more efficient ones. This process allows for the proliferation of capabilities in open source and open weight models, and it helps companies to make those model capabilities available to more users in the form of smaller versions of high-performing models. Distillation makes AI models more scalable by reducing their size, which will make AI models more accessible and applicable to more use cases. Imagine if every student began university with the accumulated knowledge of every student and professor who had gone before them. Now imagine that same student being invited to compete with hundreds of other virtual students, all with the same knowledge, with the goal of optimizing for a specific objective. This is the idea of machine-driven reinforcement learning, a technique where AI improves itself through self-play, experimentation, and refining its own thinking. This method of learning has been instrumental in some of the most famous AI breakthroughs of our time, including AlphaGo's triumph over human players of the ancient game of Go. By leveraging AI systems to create their own training curricula, we open an entirely new vector for scale, limited only by the capacity of ever more intelligent machines to discover new things. One of the most remarkable applications of AI being used to refine AI is Google's Gemini co-scientist model, a virtual scientific collaborator multi-agent AI system that is designed to replicate the process for the scientific method, but at superhuman scale and speed. Google's AI co-scientist leverages what's called test-time compute scaling, additional computation during the inference step, to simulate scientific reasoning, test various hypotheses, and critique its own review process over time. This additional time for computation allows for this AI model to employ a number of these techniques to use synthetic data, reinforcement learning, and agentic coordination of multiple domain-specific models to produce scientific results. It's akin to having an army of the best educated scientists in the world who ceaselessly compete to discover new things, an army that is never tired, never complained, and is constantly improved. This type of approach is not an example of AI building AI, but it shows how these new vectors for scaling have the potential to transform innovation in other sectors. Now imagine an army of computer scientists with the goal of optimizing the development and speed of LLMs. That's what Tokyo-based Sakana AI recently announced, an AI CUDA engineer, a fully automated multi-agent framework for the optimization of CUDA kernels, the coding functions that run on NVIDIA GPUs. In other words, this is an AI system that rapidly speeds up other AI systems, 10 to 100 times faster than previous methods. AI is building AI at an ever faster rate. We must accept our inability to perfectly predict how these AI systems will develop and what innovation they might unlock. Most innovations are born out of trial and error over time, often many years or decades. These AI systems replicate the trial and error process through ceaseless experimentation at an astounding scale. We scarcely have a conception of what capabilities, even creativity, might emerge from AI systems as they tackle computation and reasoning at ever higher levels, which could soon surpass the ability of any human being to imagine. Observers of technological progress are in for a wild ride these next few years. Even the very notion of the innovator will change as more breakthroughs come not from a single individual's achievement or discovery, but from AI systems endlessly iterating. For the past several decades, humans have contributed to the field of computer science and artificial intelligence with the hope of creating AI systems that can replicate the best of human knowledge and reason. But recent developments in the field of AI suggest that we may be approaching a moment when the AI systems we have created progressively bootstrap themselves to build their successors. The next great inventors, those who discover the next critical medical treatment, create new materials, or unlock the mysteries of the cosmos or the atom, may not be human at all. Our next story comes from Bloomberg Businessweek, and it's called "The Real Reason Trump is Pushing Buy American." The marketing slogan is supposed to alter consumer habits and bolster domestic manufacturing, but its long history reveals darker motivations. When a horde of angry colonists barged aboard ships in Boston Harbor to pitch hundreds of chests of imported tea into the water, some of them suspected they were fomenting a revolution. They probably didn't realize they were also galvanizing a marketing campaign that would endure for centuries. The Boston Tea Party was the pinnacle of the non-importation movement, in which colonists protested British rule by boycotting goods from overseas and shaming others into doing the same. For early Americans, this outburst of economic nationalism was existential. It helped spread the view that England was an outside enemy and encouraged people to act against the country's economic domination. More recently, the concept has been winnowed down to something pithier: Buy American. Buy American campaigns with somewhat less revolutionary aims have been periodically invoked ever since. Most recently, President Donald Trump, who dubbed himself the Buy American, Hire American president during his first term, has countered opposition to his administration's chaotic tariff regime by telling supporters that purchasing goods made in the U.S. will strengthen the country. The theory behind his move is classic protectionism. Unfettered foreign imports undermine American industry, so making those goods less desirable to consumers by raising their price safeguards highly paying U.S. manufacturing jobs and expands the domestic economy. The logic is compelling to people on both sides of the political aisle. Lots of Americans perceive foreign goods as inferior junk anyway, so why not buy things that help our neighbors stay employed? The question of whether Buy American campaigns actually work depends on how you define success. Taken at face value, the most obvious indicator of their efficacy would be a durable, even if marginal, reversal in consumption trends at a national level. The mix of domestic and imported goods consumed would edge back toward the domestic. There is little evidence to this effect, though the data is muddled somewhat. The biggest Buy American campaigns have been introduced during recessions and paired with onerous tariffs, both of which on their own reliably tank the number of goods entering the country, according to data from the St. Louis Federal Reserve. The same data shows that once a recession ends, imports tick back up to their previous trend line very quickly. If nationalist sentiment alone were enough to change American consumer habits, you'd expect to see it move the needle in ways that don't adhere so tightly to the nation's overall economic conditions. Another indicator that Buy American campaigns work would be the growth in the number of jobs in the country's manufacturing sector, or, at the very least, the preservation of existing jobs. This, too, doesn't seem to be the case. In her book, Buy American: The Untold Story of Economic Nationalism, the historian Dana Frank identifies the two largest Buy American campaigns as those waged in the 1930s and the 1980 eras, during which the U.S. was hemorrhaging manufacturing jobs. In the 1930s, President Herbert Hoover's tariff regime, the Smoot-Hawley Act, deepened the Great Depression. A significant manufacturing recovery didn't happen until the massive government investment in defense procurement that came along with the U.S. entrance into World War II. Many of the manufacturing gains made during that era were sustained for decades after, and high rates of union membership in industrial trades helped establish a period of unprecedented growth and prosperity for middle-class workers. Domestic manufacturing employment peaked in mid-1979 at 19.6 million jobs, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Then came the oil crisis, the Volcker shock, and Reagan's war against the unions. By early 1983, almost 3 million of those jobs were gone. About half returned in the mid-80s when the recession ended, but the U.S. would never again surpass the high point from the late 1970s, even as Buy American campaigns raged on. In both of these historical instances, the flood of private sector investment into American industry that was supposed to follow all of that purchasing of American products never came. In a modern world of globalized supply chains, what it would take for a Buy American campaign to work becomes even more confusing. Goods and services are not straightforwardly foreign or domestic. Delta is a U.S. airline that flies hundreds of planes made by Airbus, which is headquartered near Toulouse, France, and builds its aircraft at factories in Europe and North America. So does flying Delta constitute buying American? Honda is Japanese, but it manufactures the Accord in Ohio. Does that count? What about a Chevrolet Silverado? An American company manufactures that particular model in factories in the U.S., Mexico, and Canada using some imported components. And these are just the kind of rare purchases that most people take the time to sit down and think through. In industries so highly regulated that the average person can find out quite a lot by their product's origins. What about everything else? Even if your cotton sweater was knitted in the U.S., do you have any idea how to find out where the cotton was grown? If Buy American campaigns don't achieve their stated aims, then what's their purpose? According to Frank, the most high-profile of these efforts have a couple of things in common. First, they tend to be spearheaded by corporate interests, even though they're often also supported by lots of regular people. In the run-up to the American Revolution, many in the wealthy merchant class supported boycotts of imports, at least in part because it gave them enormous leverage to sell subpar goods languishing in their inventories and demand high prices for smuggled foreign products. In 1933, the newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst astroturfed the Buy American movement to prominence, ordering his more than two dozen newspapers to feature it on their front pages every day for months. In the 1980s, one of Buy American's most ardent backers was Roger Milliken, a South Carolina-based textile magnate, infamous union buster, and future co-founder of the Heritage Foundation. He put millions of dollars into the campaign marketing efforts as part of its Crafted with Pride organization, which did things like produce television ads about American jobs being lost to foreign workers, sponsor the Miss America pageant, and prod Walmart into creating displays of American-made products in its stores. The second commonality is that they come at times of significant national wounds. Of Hearst, Frank writes, the Buy American movement of early 1933 was possible only because his arguments landed in a fertile field, a nation in crisis, with its president in denial, in which many people were already in the mood to turn inward. Broad-based Buy American movements historically reject not only foreign goods, but also foreign or non-white workers, even those on U.S. soil. In this way, at least, Buy American campaigns work beautifully. They take existing dissatisfaction and unrest among U.S. workers and reorient it in a way from those wielding power domestically and toward a foreign threat. Suddenly, the most important relationship in the labor economy isn't between workers and owners, but between Americans and their foreign opponents. And big businesses can more easily cast itself as an ally to the everyman. They'd love to treat their workers well if only they had the customers could afford to do it. Over the course of decades, the American manufacturing industry has been hollowed out, its secure union jobs largely replaced with more precarious service and care work. The U.S. is a deeply divided country where wealth has become steadily more concentrated among the top decile earners. a phenomenon that a growing swath of Americans now blame, at least in part, on immigrants pushing native-born workers out of good jobs or sucking up public resources they don't deserve. Americans are taught to think of themselves as consumers with economic duties above and beyond their civic duties, which makes the patriotic duty of shopping possible on a conceptual level. The surface logic of Buy American has always been an easy sell across the political spectrum, a way to score unity points even if it doesn't change behavior. The new administration is just playing the hits. Our next story comes from Fox Business, and the article is entitled, "Nearly Half of Generation X is Not Confident About Retirement," a survey finds. As Generation X continues getting closer to retirement, some have less than rosy views about their retirement prospects, according to a recently released non-probability-based study from Fidelity Investments. Fidelity Investments found in the latest edition of its annual State of Retirement Planning study that 45% of Gen Xers, those between the ages of 44 and 59, reported feeling that they were not confident in their ability to retire when and how they want. Meanwhile, 53% felt confident that they could, in fact, do so. Gen X is most likely to be what we call the sandwich generation right now, Fidelity Investments Vice President of Retirement Offerings Rita Assaf told Fox Business. They are caring for both children and aging parents, as well as preparing for retirement. That's pretty costly. They're also at a time where higher cost of living, so we're helping with the children. They're most likely have kids in college, or maybe they just finished college, and those costs have been much higher, she continued. Their day-to-day expenses are much higher, and we also know with aging parents the health care and long-term care costs associated with that as well. Assaf said that Gen X being poised to be the first 401k generation has also driven those figures. Current retirees are primarily using still pensions as their primary way to fund their retirement savings. But Gen X, I think our study found 61% will be leveraging 401ks and IRAs and individual savings vehicles for retirement. So that's a big difference as well, she noticed. Compared to last year's study, Gen X confidence in retiring when and how they want dropped 16 percentage points, something that Assaf linked to higher cost of living and members of the generation moving nearer to retirement age. She said the survey really highlighted the fact that with higher cost of living, there's a bit of general concern that will my retirement savings last? Gen X notably hold the most negative retirement outlook among the four generations included in the study, according to Fidelity Investments. The study found Gen Z and millennials felt the most confident about retiring on their own terms at 75 and 71% respectively. Meanwhile, 68% of baby boomers reported that they were confident. For Gen X, juggling children, aging parents, and higher cost of living have played into that. Assaf also said that anxiety tends to raise as you get close to retirement. Younger generations like Gen Z and millennials still have a long time horizon, so they're actually feeling more confident and have more time on their hands to save more and invest and reap the benefits of compound earnings. Overall, 67% of those in their retirement planning years felt positively when it came to retiring, when and how they want. The study was based on a survey that involved over 2,000 adult financial decision makers with a minimum of one investment account. Socking away sufficient money, inflation, and high cost of living, striking the balance covering expenses now versus saving for retirement and figuring out the amount of funds needed for retirement were among the issues respondents identified as those posing the most challenge, according to the study. Meanwhile, among current retirees, the golden years were going as planned for 72% of the study. A similar share, 70%, also felt that their retirement planning set them up sufficiently. When it comes to retirement income, 77% of retirees pointed to Social Security as their top source, according to the study. Behind that were pensions at 48% and personal savings at 41%. Planning does not stop at retirement, Assaf told Fox Business. You have to keep evolving your planning even when you're in retirement. The savings of 7 in 10 retirees have taken a hit from the rising cost of living, the survey said. The Transamerica Center for Retirement Studies found in an August 2024 report that the median age of retirement for middle-class retirement was now 62. Americans think that $1.46 million is the amount of money necessary to experience a comfortable retirement, according to a study released by Northwestern Mutual last year. Our next article for this episode comes from Vox, and it's called Why It Still Takes Days for Banks to Give You Your Money. It's the 21st century. Instant bank transfers should be the norm everywhere. If you want to observe a particularly American problem, go open your phone's Venmo app, click on Me, and then click on Transfer. If you have a balance in your account, you'll be given two options. Option one gives you your money for free, but in up to 3 business days. The other option is instant, but comes with a price tag of 1.75% of the transfer, going up to $25 for large transactions. Getting access to your own money comes with a price, either in time or in cash. The problem is relatively trivial when it comes to settling up restaurant bills with your friends, but for more life-critical things like rent or paychecks, these delays really matter. It's an especially embarrassing situation when other countries like Brazil, Japan, and the United Kingdom make instant bank transfers ubiquitous and affordable years ago. If you work through the full cost of what Americans pay for their payment system, Dan Arway, a professor at the Cornell Law School and an expert on payment systems, told me, it's probably the most expensive payment system in the G20 by a pretty significant margin. The Brookings Institution, Aaron Klein, one of the few vocal advocates for instant payments, has estimated that the cost to consumers from delayed payments, from overdraft fees to interest on the loans Americans take out to cover their expenses, could be as much as $10 billion a year. In fairness, the U.S. is trying to do better. For years, the Federal Reserve has been building out an instant payment system called FedNow, meant to supplement or eventually supplant traditional ACH transfers. The slow but cheap multi-day check clearing system now used for many transactions, like paychecks and rent payments. So far, though, it's been largely a bust. The service's most recent quarterly report for Q3 24 reported only 336,000 transactions. By contrast, the Fed processed 5 billion ACH transfers that quarter. Next to that, FedNow is a rounding error. FedNow offers faster payments at a lower price to banks, which could help workers get paychecks earlier and move money between accounts more easily, possibly avoiding costly overdraft charges. So why have so few banks switched over? Klein describes it as a case of industry sabotage. Banks maximize profit, he summarizes. The slow payment system is more profitable to them. Well, how does money move? To understand why, let's back up for a second. How exactly does money move around the banking system right now? The main method, familiar from getting direct deposited paychecks or depositing physical checks, is ACH. This is known as a deferred net settlement system. Individual checks are not processed on their own. If my granddad sends me a check for $50 and I deposit it in my checking account, my bank does not, the second that happens, add $50 to my balance and tell my granddad's bank to debit $50 from his. Instead, a few times a day, the payment authority will collate millions of checks payments made and then deduct or add the total amount for that specific bank's owed when all those payments are processed. This is the net part of the settlement. Once their own books are settled, banks then confirm the changes in individual checking or savings accounts. ACH has changed the speed up over years, but this basic approach remains the same. Even so-called same-day ACH often don't post the day they're initiated. Zelle, the instant peer-to-peer payment system offered by most banks, is just a wrapper on ACH. Payments can still take days to settle, even though funds are made available earlier than usual to customers. So payments aren't processed in real time, but in batches at regular intervals. That means waiting. Who benefits from the system? Not the people sending or receiving the payments, of course, but banks benefit in a few ways. While payments are processed, the sending bank can still use the money being transferred, the float, to make profitable loans. The system's sluggishness used to be an even bigger problem back when checks needed to be physically present at the bank where they were deposited before a transaction could be processed. banks had to use car and plane courier systems to schlep checks around. And on September 11th, with planes grounded, $47 billion in mid-process payments were stuck, unable to settle. To avoid a repeat of that experience, Congress in 2003 finally passed the Check 21 Act, eliminating the requirement for checks to be physically present. That cut check processing times by one day on average, which per one study saved check recipients over $1 billion a year, money that used to accrue to the banks. While Check 21 reduced float revenue for banks, delays in ACH means that they still get some. If the payments were instant, that source of profit would be gone. Payment delays can also lead to problems like account overdrafts, which in turn allow banks to charge consumer fees. The average cost fees users $27 per overdraft. In 2023 alone, banks earned $5.8 billion from the fees. Most large banks only earn a small share of their revenue from fees charged to checking and saving account holders, of which overdraft and non-sufficient fund fees are the most common. J.P. Morgan Chase earned 2.1% of its revenue that way per the most recent data available, while Bank of America got 2.7%. But a small handful of banks are heavily dependent on the fees to survive. Wood Forest National Bank in Texas, for instance, earned 22.4% of its revenue, over $192 million, from fees on account holders as of last year. That's more than $154.6 million in profit the bank made last year. Without fees, they would have been in the red. There are several banks in that situation. The First National Bank of Texas earned depositor fees with over three times their profit margin in 2024. Gate City Bank in Fargo, North Dakota had fees worth more than twice its profits, and so did Arvest Bank in Arkansas, owned by the Walton family of Walmart fame. While the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been pushing to lower these fees in recent years, with some success, that seems likely to end with the Trump administration's move to defang that agency. Outside the formal banking system, check clearing delays create demand for expensive and sometimes predatory services like check cashing that charge customers money for deposits that would be free at a normal bank. According to Brookings Klein, about 70% of people using check cashing services already have checking accounts. They just want the money now. Instant payments would remove the market for check cashers as well as the revenue for banks relying on those overdraft fees. What will it take to get fast payments? All that said, it would be overly simplistic to blame slow payments in the U.S. entirely on bank greed. Consumers aren't exactly demanding faster payments because credit and debit cards allow them to experience many payments as though they're instant. They're not actually instant. Settlement on credit and debit card networks happens in net, batch fashion, just like ACH, and the fees involved are exorbitant. The major credit card networks vary dramatically in what they charge, but for credit transactions, the fees are generally in the 1% to 3% range. Retailers pay that every time they charge a credit card. Debit fees used to be in that range too until Barack Obama signed the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010, which set a cap currently at 21 cents plus 0.05% of the transaction amount. But some debit transactions like cashing out your Venmo still fall outside that cap, hence the 1.7% fee for getting your Venmo cash. It's not Venmo either, as banks like PNC also charged around 2% to get your cash immediately. Credit and debit fees are ultimately passed on to consumers in the form of higher prices, but they're usually paid by the retailer and thus hidden from customers, giving them little reason to object. They're not listed on a receipt like a sales tax. For individuals, the fact that we have a very extensive credit and debit card industry and that more recent mobile banking and apps on your phone, those have made people feel fairly satisfied. Tim Massad, who served as the chair of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission from 2014 to 2017 and works on payment issues, told me demand for something better than what we have hasn't been great because what we have is reasonably efficient. Among small retailers, the demand for something better is greater and louder. Fights against high retailer fees charged by Visa and MasterCard are now a mainstay of congressional politics and the courts. Just last year, two networks agreed to cap fees after a decades-long antitrust suit by retailers. The stakes here could be large. Empirical research Alway is working on now, he said, is finding that for many small businesses, card swipe fees can eat away a large share of their net margins and could make the difference between viability and failure. If you look at the squeezing of small business margins, he says, a surprisingly large extent of that can be accounted for by merchant fees and interchange. But it'll take more than retailer anger to turn a system like FedNow from its current near moribund state into something that, say, Vox uses to send me a paycheck or that I use to send my rent to my landlord. A common threat among countries that have made the transition, like Brazil and the UK, Klein says, is a central bank that fought hard to adopt the new system and overcame objection from banks without worried about losing out. That push can yield big dividends. In Brazil, the rollout of the Pix instant payment system has pushed normal transactions at stores away from expensive debit and credit cards toward Pix, meaning that retailers pay lower fees and don't pass the costs on to customers. According to research by The Ohio State University economist Sergei Seristan, Pix also spurned much more competition among traditional banks and enabled more Brazilians to get interest-bearing accounts and loans, resulting in benefits for the average Brazilian of about $380 per quarter. But here in the U.S., the Federal Reserve is not exactly motivated to launch a push like that. Payments are, perhaps understandably, not a focus of the Fed Board of Governors, which is preoccupied with monetary policy and bank regulation. Without action from the Fed's governing body, the issue falls to the agency's staff, which does not tend to want to rock boats, certainly not those of client banks. But by not rocking the boat might mean saddling us with a costly, decrepit, out-of-date payment system for many more years to come. And our final article for this episode comes from Business Insider. And the title is Americans Are Worried About Their Jobs, Layoffs, and Rising Unemployment. You know that sensation when something feels off, but you can't quite put your finger on it? That sensation of, I don't feel so good about this, even though this is a little fuzzy. That's the state of work for many people right now, so if you're a little uneasy about the job market, you're not alone. The economy's felt like the other shoe is about to drop for quite some time now. There was the euphoria of the Great Resignation, the post-pandemic era where workers had a lot of temporary power and did some job hopping. That gave way to the confusing negativity of the vibe session when America said the economy was terrible enough, even though on paper it was good, and despite their negativity, consumers kept spending like it was good too. Then we got to the big stay where workers decided to stick to what they were doing, whether they were happy about it or not. Sentiment picked up a bit after the 2024 election when people thought a Trump 2.0 economy would look as rosy as they remembered Trump 1.0. But now the bad vibes are back. Workers are not feeling great about the labor market or their own jobs. The big stay has transformed into the big cling to your desk, suck up to your boss, and be seen in the office. Consumer sentiment has been on a downswing recently, in part because people are feeling queasy about work. The Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index fell in March, driven largely by declines in people's outlooks on income, business, and the labor market. The concerns about the future pushed the Conference Board's Expectation Index to its lowest point in 12 years, below the level that trends to signal a recession. While people feel okay about the current labor market, they're worried about their future employment prospects and their future incomes. That's a sign that people are getting worried about their own situation, said Stephanie Gouchard, a senior economist at the Conference Board, in an interview. She added that people are beginning to say they're more worried about their family financial situations, too. We're at the point where they may start changing their behavior. Surveys from the University of Michigan reflect a similar doom and gloom mood toward the labor market. Consumers' expectations for unemployment over the next year are at their worst level since the Great Recession. Two-thirds of them think unemployment will go up. According to the University of Michigan's most recent reading, consumer sentiment has declined across the economy, cutting across age, income, and politics, as people are feeling increasingly anxious about a wide variety of measures, including their own personal finances and the labor market. Even high-income consumers are worried about their situations. As with the Conference Board's findings, the University of Michigan survey shows people aren't just worried about the broader labor market, they're worried about themselves. If labor markets truly weaken, or people believe that labor markets are going to weaken, and now they're expecting their incomes to be less stable than they were before, they're not going to willingly go out on a limb and spend at the same high level, take financial risks, make more investment, start new businesses. People are not going to be comfortable doing that if they're perceiving weakness throughout the economy. On paper, the labor market remains quite solid. The unemployment rate is healthy relative to history, though it's a bit elevated from recent historic lows, and layoffs remain steady. The quit rate is a little below where it was pre-pandemic, which reflects the stay-where-you-are attitude, but overall, signs from a hard data are flashing yellow. Daniel Zhao, the lead economist at Glassdoor, told me that mentions of layoffs in the platform's employee reviews are up by 5% compared to last year and steadily climbing. Even if workers are still employed, that doesn't necessarily mean they are happy in their jobs, he said. Some of the commentary is from people talking about the ongoing effects of previous layoffs, expressing feelings of burnout because of their workplaces are understaffed, or they're worried that they'll get swept up in the next round of cuts. Employees might not see any reason why there wouldn't be another round of layoffs if they feel like the businesses and economy are in a similar position, he said. People see the headlines about a white-collar recession, and they're unnerved, whether they're knowledge workers or not. They see the news that businesses may be rethinking hiring plans and wonder if they'd be able to find a new gig if necessary. The word of the day is uncertainty. The U.S. Economic Policy Uncertainty Index is higher than it was during the pandemic. There's a constant sense of whiplash across many parts of the economy and politics. What's happening with tariffs seems to change daily. Announcements of mass government firings and confusing reinstatements are happening constantly. Many businesses and workers expected Donald Trump's second term to look like his first one, with tax cuts and relatively unserious tariff threats and a general business-friendly stance. Instead, they're faced with a new version of Trump whose tariff gyrations are making business planning impossible. Everybody hates uncertainty, whether you're talking about executives down to the frontline workers. A lot of people are like, wow, the mix of policies is worse than I thought, but I'm not exactly sure what policies are being implemented and what I should prepare for, said Guy Berger, the director of economic research at the Burning Glass Institute, a labor and analytics firm. There's a level of paralysis among the chaos. With so much instability, many workers and businesses feel like they have no choice but to stay put. That means employees are sticking with their jobs and businesses are easing off the gas on hiring until there's a better sense of what's going on.